Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The positive jobs report in America means good times for the dollar. Meanwhile, troubles with Brexit are pinching the British pound. That seems logical, and yet movements in foreign exchange rates are prickly to predict. Joe Santos is professor of macroeconomics at South Dakota State University, and he's here to help explain the exchange rate as part of our ongoing morning macro series on In the Moment. And you can follow along on Joe's blog. That's at schooled.blog.com. And Joe Santos joins us from the Janine Basinger studio at SDSU. Now, Joe, welcome. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday, Lori. Thank you.
All right. Let's start with some definitions. What essentially is the foreign exchange rate?
Right. So the exchange rate is very simply just the price of one currency in terms of another currency. So this is just a relative price in what we call monetary units. We would think nothing of saying a smartphone is $400, so you would be measuring the value of the smartphone in dollars. But when the smartphone is instead somebody else's money, this can feel a little weird. So you're saying the British pound, someone else's money, is $1.30, but that's all it is. It's a relative price in terms of monetary units. So as I like to say, it's the price of one currency in terms of another currency.
So most people interact with this when they travel overseas, when you actually are in the position of trading your dollars for euros, for example. It's more than that, though.
That's right. So that's what we would think of as the retail foreign exchange market. If you think of this in very concrete terms, you know, walking up to an exchange booth in the airport and exchanging one money for another money at some, exchange rate between the two monies. That's the retail market. But the foreign exchange rates, and there are tens of them, are set in what we call the wholesale foreign exchange market. So this is a world that, you know, the tourist doesn't deal with directly. These are banks, what we refer to as dealers in the foreign exchange market, and they, you know, buy low and sell high, hopefully for their sake, these various currencies. And so they're trading back and forth in an elaborate network of these financial intermediaries or banks, simply put, and buying and selling the currencies from one another. As a practical matter, they're not actually exchanging little bags of money, you know, with dollar signs and pound signs on them. They're actually exchanging rights to ownership of bank accounts. So it's really bank accounts that are going back and forth between these intermediaries. And depending on what the terms of those trades are, that determines the foreign exchange rate. And so then the rest of us, when we're at the airport in, you know, Madrid, are essentially buying and selling currencies at those rates. But as I say, the trillions of dollars a day that move back and forth between these intermediaries, that's really what determines the so-called market clearing prices of one currency in terms of another. And then the rest of us are simply passively buying or selling at those market determined rates.
So that means there is money to be made and money to be lost in this, which is why we want to know how to predict it. Am I on the right track here?
Right. So that's right. So you can imagine, I mean, you may be a speculator and you may be looking to just take advantage of what you deem to be opportunities of a low price for one currency in terms of another, a price that you think will have to go up at some point, and so you buy low. But that's a kind of a speculative motive for buying currencies. Everyone else, let's say not the tourists, but for firms who have global positions and so on, so they're buying inputs in one country and they're selling outputs in another country, they're keenly aware of the exchange rate because, again, they're buying and selling in different currencies for commercial reasons, not speculative reasons. But nevertheless, they would really like to know if the value of one currency is going to change one way or the other before, let's say, they need to buy or sell in that currency. So there are very I was about to say legitimate commercial interests. It's not to say that speculation is illegitimate, but there are very legitimate commercial reasons why large international conglomerates, for example, including financial institutions, want to have a sense of, let's say, which way the dollar is going to go against the euro or, you know, what have you.
If you are a regular, in quotations, the word regular investor, so you have a mutual fund or something, do you care about the exchange rate, or is this only a game that large global corporations play?
Sure. No, you care because essentially what you're doing as a, let's say, global investor is, you know, let's think of it very concretely. You're buying, let's say, bank accounts, and you're putting your money into a bank account. Economists tend to refer to that as buying one. So you're buying a bank account in, France, or you're buying a bank account in the United States. And those accounts have returns attached to them. You know, an interest rate is paid on one or the other bank account. So that's part of your motive for buying one or the other account. But of course, the other issue is that, let's say if you are going to buy the one in France, first you're going to have to get your hands on euros, and then you're going to buy the bank account. And then, of course, at some point, presumably, you're going to reverse course and you're going to sell the bank account, which means at some point you'll have to go back, sell your euros and get back into dollars. So part of your reward, if you will, for saving in France is that interest rate, but part of it is the, in the case that I've described, the appreciation of the euro while you hold on to euros. At least that's how you'd like it to work out, so that you don't just earn the interest rate, but you also have what we call a capital gain in the value of the currency going up while you held on to it. So, you know, you can have a situation where you have a very high interest rate being paid on some account in some country, but of course, that return can be completely overwhelmed, washed away, if while you're in that other currency, so to speak, it falls in value. And so when it's time to get back out, as it were, into dollars, you may have experienced a capital loss. So it's not just the interest rate that one or another investment pays you as a saver in, let's say, as you said, a mutual fund. It's also what the currency is going to do, rise or fall, while you are invested in it. And so that is a very serious concern for, let's call them, international savers who don't just buy bank accounts in their own country, but buy them in every other. And of course, I'm using bank accounts, but all of this would apply to stocks, bonds, real estate, what have you. Anytime you're going to have to get into a currency and then at some point get out of that currency and return to your own, you have the potential for a gain or a loss just on the basis of what the currency did while you held it.
So the better that the U.S. dollar, for example, is doing, then that makes the, you know, investments in U.S. dollars more attractive as well. What does it sort of, you know, what does the strength of one currency over the others do for that nation's economy is what I'm getting at there.
Yeah. Oh, you're getting at a very big, good question. So on a, let's say, think of this sort of just on the basis of arithmetic. If you're an American exporter, and so you're selling goods and services that you denominate in dollars, if someone, let's go back to France, is going to buy that good or service, if the dollar is very strong, it takes a lot of their money to buy a dollar, then in effect, your exports are expensive. So a strong dollar can reduce the competitiveness of U.S. exports. Likewise, a strong dollar can make imports very competitively priced from the perspective of an American who buys that product first by buying the currency, which in my little example is relatively weak against the dollar. So a strong dollar can challenge exports because, all else equal, those exports can be rendered less competitive because you have to buy this expensive dollar to buy the export. But likewise, our imports, the things we may enjoy from other countries, can be very reasonably priced from our perspective because of the strength of that dollar. So just on the basis of sort of net export arithmetic, there is this effect of a currency on what we call the trade balance. On net, are you exporting or importing? That's the balance. So there is this relationship, and that's the one that you hear a lot about, that when the dollar is strong, those folks who depend on, let's say, foreign consumers are concerned that they may not, the exporters may not be too as competitive as they once were. And this takes us back actually to agriculture in the case of this region of the world. Strong dollars have the effect of making commodities relatively expensive abroad, and that could compromise the competitiveness of exporters of agricultural goods, for example. But then there's this other side of the strong dollar that you're getting at with this great question, and that is, you know, there is something sort of anathema to our sense of national pride of saying, you know, we want a weak dollar. And so there is this sort of rhetoric around the dollar that says, of course, you know, we want the dollar to be strong. And I don't think that's foolish, but it is true that as that dollar is strong, then so too is the case that it's going to take a lot of other people's money in order to buy the dollar. So there is this sort of ambiguity about how we speak about the dollar. Sure, strong dollar sort of signifies a sense of sort of national pride and strength, but in terms of net export arithmetic, it has an effect on exports that can render them less competitive than they might otherwise be.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment. This is our morning macro segment, and you can follow along at Joe Santos' blog at schooled.blog.com, and a little bit of crash course in economic literacy. You can go back and read all the blog posts, and you can find the conversations at listen.sdpb.org. And so what I'm wondering, Joe, is how volatile it can be. How quickly can it change? How long does it take it to change? Let's talk about that for a while.
Yeah. So in the short run, exchange rates are extremely volatile. I'm only half joking when I say, you know, macroeconomists essentially identify the exchange rate as the macroeconomic variable that is the most difficult to explain, let alone predict. Just a quick background, or a very intuitive one. I mean, you can think of why this is. If you have 150 different exchange rates in the world, the sort of general equilibrium of every single one of these exchange rates equaling the other one so that markets clear around the world, that's a pretty dynamic, complex process. Some might even say chaotic. And so trying to predict what the net effects of that process might be, you know, is very difficult to do. In terms of why it's so volatile, again, you can think of the volatility in terms of just two currencies. Let's say it's the British pound and the US dollar. It goes back to this idea of your question about that saver, the saver who buys bank accounts here versus buys bank accounts abroad. Any changes in interest rates between two countries will immediately change one's incentive to go into one currency versus another. You know, I want to be where the interest rate is highest. And that's just the half of it. Then there's the expectation about which way one exchange rate might go relative to another. So, for example, all might be right with the world this morning, and the British pound and the US dollar have some exchange rate between them. And then all of a sudden, I and a couple million other savers get the idea that the British pound is not going to maintain its exchange against the dollar. It's going to fall. And so I immediately pull out of any pound-denominated bank accounts, and I rush into dollars. So there's a case where it's simply an expectation that I may not earn as much if I stay in pounds as I would if I'd stay in dollars. And the expectation becomes self-fulfilling because I immediately move that financial capital around the world. And by the way, it moves very quickly and very easily. And so I quickly move it somewhere else. And so this is what you're observing. Now, that was between the pound and the dollar. Now, you know, add 156 other currencies into that with exchange interest rates in each of those countries and so on. And you get this, as you put it, very volatile short-term behavior in all exchange rates. And so the opener you went with speaking about Brexit and so on, there's a case in point. We've been watching this play out now for some time, but most recently there is this sense now that Theresa May will, the Prime Minister, will request yet another delay. Well, the thinking is that will have a negative effect on the pound. So why wait? Let's just get out now, right? And so the pound fell against the dollar last Friday when that announcement of further delay was made. Nothing, let's say, actually happened, but expectations were formulated in such a way that the pound moved nevertheless. So,
but that's not necessarily a negative thing for British exports, but it's a negative thing Is it a negative thing for more than just national pride, though? I mean, it's a negative in other ways. Explain that.
It is. It is, because volatility, we assume all investors are what we call risk averse. All else equal, I would prefer to not have volatility in any economic variable. So you don't want to be known as the currency on the block that is the most volatile, unpredictable, whimsical, and so on. That's not a place a lot of investors are going to want to park their savings. So, what you'd really like is strong and stable, right? I imagine that. But if it's strong one day and weak the next, rather than evaluate the benefits of strength versus weakness, I'm guessing most investors will just look at it and think up one day, down the next. If the spread between those two points is large, that signals volatility, and that's not a place this risk averse investor wants to be. So that's what you really want to stay away from, is volatility, because then no one wants to engage with you, not just in financial investments, though that's the place they're likely to run from first, but even trade arrangements, long-term contracts between importers and exporters are going to be really complicated if you have to worry about this exchange rate in that way.
All right. So how, Brexit seems like an obvious thing that would cause anxiety or volatility. Are there quirky, sort of strange things that trigger that kind of volatility? a soccer game or an election, or, how picky can that market get about what's happening in a country?
Yeah, that's a good question. As picky as the investors can sort of formulate in their heads, and that's what's so scary. The election, certainly, no question. Soccer game, it depends on, on the extent of the nation's obsession with soccer, perhaps. But sure, I mean, your point is well taken. There are a lot of currencies to choose from. And if suddenly investors get a sense that one or the other country is not the right place to be sort of parked in, if you will, in terms of their financial investments, then the currency moves very quickly as those investments run away. We talked earlier on the show, earlier episodes, of things like monetary policy and so on. That's a big one. So, every day we're discussing whether or not the Fed is going to raise or lower interest rates, right? Well, again, the anticipation just gets folks' minds working, thinking, well, suppose the Fed does raise interest rates. Well, then a dollar would be a nice place to be, because you'd earn a higher interest rate on dollar-denominated deposits. Well, I, on a whim, think that's probably the right bet. So now I go in and I buy dollars early to try to get on the ground floor. That's an example where I'm anticipating monetary policy. I'm trying to second guess Chairman Powell of the Federal Reserve System and determine what he's going to announce with respect to interest rates. That sort of second and triple guessing can create a lot of volatility in the market. Elections, comments policymakers make, those are the sorts of things we're constantly watching for. And as I say, it's all made more volatile by the fact that oftentimes we don't wait to hear it. We try to anticipate it and act beforehand. And so that adds even more volatility.
So one of the things I'm learning as we have these conversations is, in my mind, I think, in the age of algorithms, some of these things should be really consistent and predictable. And yet it's all human behavior. Macroeconomics is really the study of human behavior in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. There, yes. We are a social science. You are absolutely right. Fundamentally.
I didn't get that in some way before we started.
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. We are social scientists. We study human behavior. We study it in the context of sort of trade and how individuals make choices with limited resources. But yes, it is all about human behavior and expectations that drive that behavior. That's absolutely correct.
You can learn so much more at schooled.blog.com. That's Joe's blog. Find it online. We'll put a link up after our show to listen.sdpb.org. Joe Santos, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Lori. Take care.